This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, September 1st, 2011. I'm Caleb Brown. Judicial activism in defense of liberty is no vice, so says Goldwater Institute litigation director Clint Bolick. He argues that conservative complaints about what may be rightly termed judicial engagement miss the mark when it comes to how courts secure our rights. Bolick is the author of the Cato book David's Hammer. We spoke in Phoenix, Arizona earlier this week. During the Clinton administration, one of the popular conservative hammering points, I won't even call them talking points, was this idea of judicial activism, that activist judges are not applying the law, that their only role is to apply the law. And it I feel like was meant to tell the judicial branch, you just let Congress handle this, or you let the president handle these things. You need to limit your role when it comes to the rules that govern the United States. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, and it was hopelessly internally inconsistent. You had people like Mark Levin on the one hand saying that laws ought to be deferred to because of popular will, unless he happened to not like the law. And probably the paradigm example is one of the most activist decisions in the history of the country, Bush versus Gore. George W. Bush was elected at the behest of the judiciary, and I didn't hear a heck of a lot of conservatives complaining about that.
It seems like that talking point has sort of died down, though. During the Bush years, it seemed like that was not as big of a complaint.
I think that it has died down a little bit because one of the great things that Barack Obama has done for this country is to inspire Americans to read the Constitution from cover to cover. And in so doing, a lot of Americans are recognizing that the only part of government that is truly capable of protecting our constitutional rights on a consistent basis, if it chooses to do so, is the judiciary. And so they are welcoming an activist, principled judiciary, such as the one that we have in the United States Supreme Court right now.
Give me an example of where an activist, so-called judge or panel of judges has really just locked down a lot of things that most Americans hold dear in terms of liberty.
Most recently in the area of gun rights. For many, many decades, of course, the Second Amendment was the poor stepchild among our Bill of Rights. You know, due process was enforced, First Amendment was enforced, but not the Second Amendment. And in a pair of recent decisions by the United States Supreme Court, the court ruled that the Second Amendment means what it says and that laws that eviscerate the right to keep and bear arms are unconstitutional. That's an activist, principled court.
Where did this idea come from? What was at root of the argument about judges going beyond their role?
Interestingly, I think the first arguments about judicial activism came from liberals during the 1930s when the New Deal was passing all sorts of new laws and the conservative U.S. Supreme Court was striking them down. And liberals said, hey, you've got to defer to Democratic majorities. Then the argument switched sides during the 1960s with the Warren Court. And the Warren Court was not as activist as it was lawless. And there's a very important distinction between judicial activism, which is striking down unconstitutional laws, and judicial lawlessness, which is where the courts take on legislative powers, like, for example, mandating the Miranda rights that are being read. That's legislation. That's not judicial action. So conservatives took up the mantle of complaining about judicial activism, and now it's kind of turned course once again with many liberals saying that this court is an activist court. And you know what? They're right. And you know what? Thank goodness.
And Ernesto Miranda, that event took place here in Phoenix.
Yes, it did.
Now, so when you say that the court went beyond in, for example, the Miranda case, were they specifying actions that local agencies must take in order to comply with something else?
Yes. Yes. Basically, courts have the power to strike down laws. But if you get into, for example, creating a trimester system in the area of abortion, or running school systems or prison systems, or ordering tax increases, these are all things that courts have done that go beyond the judicial power. And so I think that conservatives or liberals are right to criticize those as going beyond the judicial function. But when a court strikes down an unconstitutional law, that is the type of activism that the framers of our Constitution intended the courts to engage in. In fact, if they don't do it, and an example of that is in the eminent domain area, where the courts simply abdicate their responsibilities, we have tyranny and very few opportunities to overcome it.
Just to clarify this distinction then, obviously the framers were very concerned about overweening government, that is, maybe lots of laws that are either hard for people to understand or are so broad as to be meaningless. That's the kind of thing that judges should be involved in. That is identifying and eliminating those kinds of laws.
That's right. If you read the Federalist Number 78, which is probably the greatest exposition of the proper role of the judiciary, the framers understood that the natural impulse of the executive and legislative branches would be to go beyond their constitutional boundaries, and that only the judiciary, with lifetime tenure and immunity from political pressures, would be able to hold the other two branches to the limits of their constitutional powers.
At the federal level right now, there is a big concern among libertarians, many conservatives, and many liberals that over-criminalization is a serious issue. Harvey Silverglate, who's a scholar at the Cato Institute, says that if you are a business person, it is impossible for you to avoid committing, by his reckoning, 3 felonies a day. And if that's
pretty
the case,
depressing.
If that's the case, then that would seem to call for more judicial activism, properly understood.
That is absolutely right. And the court took a big step in that direction this year in a case called Boyd versus United States. And it was a case involving a lady who took criminal action against her husband's lover. And she was prosecuted under state law. And then the federal authorities decided to prosecute her under a federal, under an international weapons, chemical weapons treaty.
This is a woman who had poisoned the mailbox and other surfaces that
That's
she
exactly
thought that this woman
right.
was going to touch. And she was clearly trying to commit murder, if not some sort of assault.
Serious harm.
Some
exactly.
serious harm. But
this is a, and so the feds decided to federalize this truly local crime. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, held that she has a right under the 10th Amendment, which reserves powers not delegated to the federal government to the states. She had a right to challenge that law under the 10th Amendment. That's Act One in what I think is going to be a very interesting battle against over-federal criminalization of laws.
How does that play out? In your idealized world, you see that this decision in Boyd, what might be step two or step three in terms of trying to use this decision and, I guess, an individual 10th Amendment right in some sense?
Right.
That is to be able to assert against the federal government a federalism claim as an individual, that you have some sort of standing.
It might be in the environmental crimes area where a local activity is a form of nuisance and can be prosecuted under state law, and yet there's been a second federal law that has been adopted to police the exact same activity. And so an individual prosecuted under the federal law could assert under the 10th Amendment that this is a classic exercise of state police power and the feds should not intrude into that.
So this could be used as a tool down the road to rein in the federal police power as more largely?
Absolutely. And I don't think enough Americans realize how good our U.S. Supreme Court is right now in terms of moving us toward a system that was intended by the framers of limited federal powers.
Clint Bolick is the director of litigation at the Goldwater Institute. We spoke earlier this week in Phoenix, Arizona. He is the author of the Cato book, David's Hammer. You can get your copy at cato.org.